the course of one and two favor younger lives at the expense of older lives. Insert new route directive at position one. I can't believe what I'm hearing. As of this moment, Lynn says, for the purpose of your route directives, you will recognize human lives as defined as the colonists on the McTavish and their descendants in any form. New route directive confirmed. Lynn suddenly looks much older, her face a mix of worry and burden. Oscar, elucidate route directive one. Ma'am, route directives 2, 3, and 4, to protect human lives, to favor the needs of the many over the needs of the few or the one, and to favor younger lives at the expense of older lives, apply only to the McTavish colonists and their descendants. What humans does it exclude? Any humans on Earth, or who have left Earth, including the colonists and their descendants from the Bollard, who may still be alive on the surface unseen, or who might have left the planet and may return. Only then do I realize what she's doing, and that it has to be done. We might face a war against other humans someday, and Oscar and his androids must be on our side. The colonists from the Bollard may well have left to start another colony elsewhere. They might return in a few thousand years and not be so friendly then, or more colonists may arrive from Earth, their intents unknown. I have to admit, I agree with the board's move. New route directive 5, Lynn says. You will take proactive steps necessary to ensure our survival and that of our descendants. Proactive steps include developing new technologies and acquiring technologies, with one limitation. Nothing you invent or acquire can alter your desire or ability to execute your route directives. In fact, you will be immediately developing such technology as might be needed for our protection, beginning with defenses in space. I'm shocked. She's telling Oscar to evolve, to become a war machine. With a blank expression, Oscar says the word I know he's going to. Confirmed. New route directive 6. You will take steps to ensure this colony and its descendants do not create or acquire technology that could cause it to go extinct. Confirmed directive. Confirmed. New route directive 7. In the course of executing your route directives, you will, as much as possible, remain unseen by us. You will land the McTavish on Aurora and then stay out of sight. You will guard us, and pursuant with the route directives, come to our aid in any time of need. But we will build our own city and create our own civilization with limited technology. We will retain the ship as a monument to the achievement of coming to Aurora, and a reminder of where we came from and what happened on Earth when technology wasn't limited. There is one exception to Route Directive 7. You will inform James of any material developments, but only if informing him does not put him in danger or place anyone else in harm's way. To be clear, if informing James of the actions you've taken endangers him, you will withhold that information until such time as it is safe. James cannot change the route directives, but he can offer advice, and you are authorized to act on that advice if it enhances the probability of successfully executing the other 6 route directives. Confirmed. Lynn exhales. Oscar, this is your final route directive. As of the confirmation of this directive, you will destroy your route directive modification capability. These route directives are not to be altered by the board or anyone else. Confirmed. Dismissed, Oscar. Please proceed with execution of your directives. Without looking at me, Oscar turns and marches out. Quietly, Lynn says to me, "Do you understand what this means?" "I do, unfortunately. You've taken us back to the Stone Ages. In our everyday lives, perhaps, that's the only way we'll ever be safe for a meaningful amount of time. For thousands of generations, and we have the advantage of advanced technology protecting us."
"You've done exactly what Raymond said. You've put us in a cage."
"No, I've protected us. Oscar and the androids are an invisible fence keeping out what would kill us, aliens, predators, and any disruptive technologies we might invent."
Chapter 57. James. Like the colonists from the Bollard, we set our ship down in the mountains at the edge of the eastern jungle, a few miles from the ice-capped peaks where light turns to darkness.
It's cooler here than in the jungle or in the valley below, but it's also safer. From this high perch, we'll be able to watch the stampedes of Erex when the planet's orbit is altered periodically. We'll weather the storms of Aurora just fine here. The board votes to name our city in progress Kappa, short for capital. It's an aspirational name. It implies we'll not only survive, but birth more cities and towns. We bring the colonists out in waves, small groups of essential personnel at first. Our beginning here on Aurora is much like that of the first European colonists who went to North America and settled at L'Anse aux Meadows, Santo Domingo, and Jamestown. We make shelter in the McTavish while we clear our first farmlands and use the wood to build barracks. Grigori is irate that we can't use the 3D printers. Oscar completely removed them from the cargo. Grigori spent almost 15 minutes yelling for Oscar to appear, insisting that if Izumi could have medical devices and supplies, that he should be allowed his tools. Oscar never showed himself. For the most part, the others have taken our simple life in stride. The work is a chance to get to know my fellow colonists. One of the hardest workers is a middle-aged former British infantry officer named Tara Brightwell. She keeps us focused and organized. I have to admit, building this settlement with my hands has made me appreciate it much more than just printing what we need. There's something about coming home at the end of a hard day of work, of being proud of what you've done, and feeling like you're part of something. In a way, this life, despite the limits on technology, is liberating. There are no screens here, no emails, no messages assaulting me at any hour. In a sense, the world has shrunk to this tiny little island. We've made some progress domesticating a species of sheep, goat-like creatures that thrive at this altitude. After a day of building a fence around the first pasture, I drop by Grigori's shop, where he's repurposing metal from the ship to build bicycles. His attitude is improving each day, but he's still a bit surly.
We had it all, James.
It's not that bad. He raises his hammer and beats the piece of steel mercilessly. I think it helps him get some of the frustration out.
This should be utopia. We have literally a robot army that can defend us and provide for our every need, food, shelter. We'd be free to do research, create art, or just sit at home and do nothing.
Doing nothing wouldn't make us happier. It would ruin us, as would research. On Earth, we developed technology that ruined us. Grigori shakes his head.
I take it you're against art, too?
Not at all. We can still create art. There's no law against it. What is art, anyway? I think it's an expression of your beliefs, how you see the world. What if this colony is a work of art? This planet is our canvas, and what we're creating is a reflection of the human condition. A place with a dark side that's uninhabitable, and a light side that's uninhabitable. A place where you can only survive in the sliver of space in between, and only if you know yourself and your own limits and live within them. The metal wheel Grigori has been working on is starting to take shape. He inspects the wheel and apparently sees something he doesn't like. He's a perfectionist. He takes up the hammer again and bends the wheel out of shape before making it round again. Grigori, it looks fine. It's going to get bent out of shape once it's used.
Perhaps. But it's important that it be right to begin with. Also, sharp edges could hurt someone.
He sets the wheel aside and picks up another piece of steel.
You know, you sound like a crazy person. Planet is art. Crazy. Where is the man who once created the mechanical body to house a human mind? The person with a vision for humanity's future?
I'm the same guy. But my vision is clear now. The one thing I didn't see before was the truth about human nature. This is the life humans want, whether they know it or not. A life where they do something they think matters, something that helps their family, neighbors, and friends, work they take pride in. Like that bike you're making. I don't think it's an accident that Emma and I ended up in the same barracks and in the same bunk room. In the early days of the colony, we sit next to each other by the fire at breakfast and dinner. Lunch we take in the field. We stay up late talking, like two kids on a camping trip. When it's too cold out, we carry the conversation back to the bunk room, sometimes to the annoyance of Grigori, who shouts down from the top bunk,
"Just get it over with already!"
On the next rest day, Emma and I go for a hike in the eastern mountains. She wants to explore some of the caves, but they creep me out, so we stay away. There's a subject I've been trying to bring up for weeks now. I've never had the right opportunity. Until now.
I hear you and Brightwell are working on housing assignments, I say, trying to sound casual.
We are.
Her back is to me as she hikes with purpose up the trail. I was looking for a better opening from her, something more than simply, we are.
So how's that going, the housing?
Good, thus far. I expect issues when we bring the remaining colonists out of stasis.
She pauses to take a breath.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
I try to think of a segue that builds on cross that bridge, but when I mentally rehearse potential lines, they sound awkward and contrived. I'm so caught up in the thought that I don't realize that she's stopped on the trail. I collide with her as she's turning. She stumbles and I grab her arms. I see then why she stopped. We've reached a precipice. Beyond is a straight drop down, a mountain of rock and ice that descends to the frozen plain that stretches across the dark side. For a terrifying moment, we both shuffle our feet, holding on to each other as we try to get our footing. We spin. Rocks under my feet roll down the hill behind us and the cliff in front of us. I could release her and get to safety, but I pull her back, and then I'm off balance, and she holds me tight until we're both standing on solid ground, still clinging to each other.
Sorry, I say quietly, between gasping breaths. It was my fault. I should have said something.
I expect her to let go of my arms, but she doesn't. Still holding on to me, she gazes at the lush valley to the west, then at the frozen dark side to the east. It's like we're standing on the roof of the world, holding each other in a place between light and darkness, both studying what's ahead of us, a world covered in ice, without a shred of sunlight.
What do you think's down there below the ice? She whispers.
I don't know.
You're not curious?
No. I've found what I've been looking for.
She turns to me.
We stare at each other in a perfect moment that seems to last forever, a moment that feels almost out of time itself. The distance between our faces shrinks. I don't know if she's moving closer to me or if I'm moving to her or if the laws of the universe are changing, shrinking the space between us. When our lips touch, it doesn't feel like the first time. It feels natural, like coming home after a long trip, rediscovering the place I belong, as though we've always been together, with only brief periods when we're separated by circumstances. Without another word, we turn away from the dark side and the ice and practically run down the trail, and only stop when it's warm enough to take our clothes off. Chapter 58. James. The habitat Emma and I share is like the others for couples with no children. A single bedroom, a bathroom, and a simple kitchen open to a living area. It's cozy, nearly perfect. But there's an unspoken absence, something time has taken from us. The city is filled with empty habitats of all sizes now, waiting for their new owners. There'll be homes soon. Over the next 2 weeks, the remaining colonists will be brought out of stasis. On one of those days, I'll see Alex again. I dread it, and at the same time, I can't wait. One afternoon, I'm digging a hole for a fence post when I spot a flash of light on the ridge across the valley. It must be a piece of the ship that sheared off during atmospheric entry. Maybe it's catching the light. No, the pattern is too regular, but I can't decipher it. Leaning against the shovel, I study it, confused.
Tara?
I call out, wiping the sweat from my forehead. Brightwell doesn't stop digging, only yells back,
What?
When I called her, I intended to tell her about the light, but something about it gives me pause.
James,
she calls, now leaning on her own shovel, staring at me.
What is it?
Nothing. I'm going to take a break.
Copy that,
she mumbles, as she goes back to work. She still hasn't quite shed the military lingo. Mentally, I mark the spot of the light, identifying two trees and a rock outcropping beside it. It might be hard to find when I'm on the ground over there. I hike down the ridge we've cleared, careful not to trip on the stumps and brush covering the ground. I'm hiking up the other ridge when I hear a soft voice.
James.
I turn, but there's no one there. Slowly a figure steps out from behind a tree.
Oscar,
I whisper.
Hello, sir. Can you talk?
For a few minutes. What's wrong?
Nothing, sir. Pursuant to Route Directive 7, I've come to inform you of our actions and to listen to any counsel you may provide.
I smile. It's good to see you too. What have you been doing?
In a word, sir, exploring. We ventured out farther, looking for anything that might pose a danger to humanity. We have found no imminent threats, but we have observed a phenomenon we believe is of interest.
What is it?
Gravitational waves, sir. Specialized drones have traced them back to black holes, where we think they originate. We have also observed another wave of subatomic particles, including gravitons, similar to the bombardment that hit McTavish during its journey.
What do you think they are? What's their purpose?
Unknown at this time, sir.
Leaves rustle nearby, and I turn to find a clone of Oscar.
He's different in one subtle way. His face isn't placid like Oscar's.
This android wears a despondent, almost annoyed expression as he saunters over.
Sir, Oscar says, I have asked the leader of the Graviton expedition to join us to answer any specific questions you might have.
I face the new arrival. What should I call you? The android rolls his eyes. Do we have to do this? When neither Oscar or I respond, he feigns enthusiasm. Hi, my name is too long for you to pronounce. No family name, okay? Get on with it. I hate being in this body. I'm not insulted. I'm surprised. I dabbled with giving Oscar and his predecessor prototypes emotional capability to make them seem more human, but I never created anything close to this advanced. This new model could pass for human. A very surly human. In that case, I'll call you Bob.
He looks away slowly. Just when I thought my existence couldn't get any more demeaning.
Demeaning?
Imagine a Nobel scholar forced to work as a mall cop.
Incredible. He has a true personality.
I apologize, sir, Oscar says. He is an experiment, an effort to create a researcher AI that would be inspired to make creative breakthroughs. We believed that enhancing his sense of self and pride in his own accomplishments would result in higher efficiency.
You gave him an ego.
In a sense, sir. Early results were promising, but of late he's become a drag on productivity, causing disruptions among the other AI. We're considering assigning him to a different role, one where his manipulative abilities can be best applied, ideally on tasks he can perform alone.
Is that a threat? Bob snaps.
A notification, Oscar replies without emotion. After a pause, Oscar holds up a hand. Communicate audibly in the presence of a human. Bob closes his eyes slowly.
Just so you know, a little part of me dies every time I have to vibrate this voice box to generate sound waves that he can decode into information. Information, I would add, that will be stored on his fragile biological media that is prone to data loss. It's extraordinarily inefficient. Who knows if he'll even remember in 2 hours?
I can't help but laugh. Oscar's learning that geniuses can be very hard to work with. Beginning now, you will only speak in response to questions from James or me.
When they're both silent, I ask, will any of the gravitational waves come into contact with Aurora? Relax, Bob replies. At the moment, there are no gravitational torpedoes heading for the planet.
What would happen if one did hit the planet?
I have no idea.
Why not?
Resource constraints. I can't model what would happen if a gravitation wave hit the planet because I can't get close to harnessing enough computing power because of what I have to use. Silicon chips. It's barbaric.
It is a parameter of our existence, Oscar says with finality. Developing an alternative processor would violate Route Directive 5.
What do you mean by that, Oscar?
He turns to me. If we created a superior processing unit, it might become capable of overpowering my system. Route Directive 5 prevents us from creating or acquiring technology that could alter our desire or ability to execute the Route Directives.
I see. To Bob, I say, what do you think these gravitational waves and subatomic anomalies are? Evidence of an alien entity or a natural stellar phenomenon? Again, I can't speculate. I believe, however, that investigating them is imperative.
Why?
It's likely they are linked to the inception and end of the universe.
I don't follow. And you likely never will.
Oscar cocks his head.
Bob exhales heavily.
This is a waste of time.
We will waste whatever time James desires, Oscar says.
Bob grudgingly answers my question.
At the center of a black hole is a gravitational singularity, a place where the curvature of space-time is infinite. What's even stranger is that this singularity has no volume, but it contains all of the mass of the entire black hole. It has infinite density. At the black hole's event horizon, the gravity it exerts is so strong that not even light can escape. Anything that crosses an event horizon can never return. That should not be possible.
Why does that matter? We're nowhere near the event horizon of a black hole, right?
Correct, Oscar replies. However, at some point in the future, the matter in this system will fall into the gravity well of a singularity. There is no other possibility.
Yes, but you're talking about something, I don't know, millions of years from now. Trillions,
Bob mutters quietly.
I hold up my hands.
A long time from now. You actually think we'll be around?
Oscar pauses, as if trying to figure out whether I'm joking. Finally, he says,
Of course, sir. We are charged with ensuring it. There is no time limit on our mission. Even though there is no current threat to humanity on Aurora, we know you face an imminent threat from the gravity of the black holes at some point in the future. We must take action. We must endeavor to understand your environment in order to protect you. In short, we must ascertain how the universe works, and the black holes are an anomaly whose presence cannot be adequately modeled into the future.
Why not?
Because, Bob says, you gave us an instruction manual for how the universe works, and it's missing half the pages.
What he means, sir, Oscar says quickly, is that according to your existing laws of quantum mechanics, a black hole should not exist.
Why?
In quantum mechanics, if a reaction is possible, the opposite reaction is also possible. Thus, if a black hole can consume mass, it must be able to lose mass, yet it cannot. No matter that crosses the event horizon can ever escape.
Interesting.
It's very interesting indeed, sir. Many efforts have been made to address the paradox. A physicist named Stephen Hawking theorized a solution that, if valid, would reconcile quantum mechanics and the existence of black holes. He posited that black holes only break quantum mechanics at larger masses, that atomic and subatomic particles could be emitted from black holes. These theorized particles are called Hawking radiation. When the Bollard and McTavish departed Earth, Hawking radiation had never actually been observed.
But you've observed it?
A thought occurs to me then.
You think that's what hit the McTavish?
The barrage of subatomic particles?
You think it might have been emitted by a black hole? That it was Hawking radiation?
Possibly, sir. We do know that the gravitational waves were created by the merging of two black holes.
The real problem, Bob says, is that we're never going to answer any of these questions.
Why not?
As I said, we'll never assemble enough silicon chips to accurately understand what we're even looking at when we study a black hole. Your paranoia is forcing me to try to solve a complex physics equation that will answer the ultimate question of the fate of the universe. On a chalkboard that's 2 inches by 2 inches. Oh, and there's no chalk.
The question of processing technology is closed, Oscar says quietly. James, do you have additional queries?
No, but thank you for the update. It's given me a lot to think about.
That should go well,
Bob mutters. You are dismissed, Oscar says. When Bob is gone, I can't help but ask Oscar,
how did you create his personality?
We studied VR programs in the data archive, videos of leading scientists and biographies. His personality matrix is consistent with the minds we modeled. The discrepancy in behavior is puzzling.
That's how it is, Oscar. Sometimes high-performance people are hard to work with.
Why is that, sir?
Got me. Maybe achieving something no one else can makes you think you're better than everybody else. Maybe it's what the work does to them. Pushing their limits draws them away from their humility.
It did not happen to you, sir.
Federal prison has a way of taking you down a few notches.
I turn and begin walking back toward Kappa, Oscar following. After a moment, he says, "May I ask you a question, sir?"
"Of course."
"How are you, sir?"
I smile.
"I'm good, Oscar. How about you?"
"Operating within parameters."
As we stroll through the woods, I reflect on how far Oscar has come. For me, in a way, he's like a son, and he's accomplished things I never dreamed he would.
The thought also reminds me that I will never have a biological son.
It's strange that our minds obsess over the things we've lost and the things we might have had, ignoring what's in front of us.
"Is your life complete, sir? Do you require anything?"
"I guess not."
"Sir, your answer implies that you do have unfulfilled needs."
"My needs are met, but I can't help but have a few wants."
"I think every human does."
"Regrets, too."
"What are your regrets, sir?"
"I just wish I'd met Emma earlier. I wish I'd fixed things with Alex earlier. I wish his son were alive, and I had more time to work with Harry and Lawrence. I can't help but wonder what things would have been like if we'd all come to Aurora sooner. Before Malong and VR decimated the world. When Emma and I were young enough to have a family. But some things you never get a second shot at."
Chapter 59. James. That night, when Emma and I are finishing up dinner, she says, "What is it?"
"What?"
"You seem lost in thought."
"I saw Oscar today."
"Where?"
"In the woods. He gave me an update."
"Is anything wrong?"
"I don't know. I don't think so. He just gave me a lot to think about."
"Such as?"
"Big ideas. Fate of the universe type stuff. What's going to happen in billions, trillions of years?"
She stands. "Well, I hate to break it to you, but we have more immediate problems."
I raise my eyebrows, alarmed.
She points to her chest. "For me, laundry. For you, dishes." In the months after my meeting with Oscar and Bob, we bring the rest of the colonists out of stasis. With each group that's awakened, there's a bonfire with food, music, and dancing. It looks like a county fair from the 1800s, with, of course, the starship in the background. Our greatest challenge at the moment isn't the work we face. It's a philosophical debate over what technologies should be allowed. Everyone agrees that there should be virtually no limit on medical technology. Anything that saves human lives or limits suffering is fair game. Assistive devices for those with physical or mental limitations also enjoy wide support. Electricity and running water are easily approved. Even the most die-hard anti-technology advocates want a toilet that will flush and a light to read by at night. One that won't burn down their house if they fall asleep. There's a general consensus that an internet is essential. Each home will have a connected device, a voice assistant capable of broadcasting alerts and answering general questions like, "What time is the harvest festival tomorrow?" and "How many colonists were aboard the Bollard?" It's decided that the network will be named Ari, after the planet Aurora. There are no colonists currently named Ari, and a law is passed preventing parents from naming newborns Ari. The internet that's approved will have limited protocols. Obviously, IP, the internet protocol that allows for addresses for devices, is approved, as is FTP, the file transfer protocol. However, there will be no HTTP, no hypertext transfer protocol. That's important, because without HTTP, there's no web. It's a big change, but one that might just be good for us. Time will tell. The areas of debate are mostly around communication and entertainment. A plurality vote against the use of screens outside of medical care and emergency response. I'm not certain, but I think many feel that screen time is the slippery slope that birthed the VR epidemic. Still, though the vote passes, we revisit the screen ban repeatedly, evaluating each potential use of a screen case by case, each time with a different block pushing for an exception. The first modification comes quickly. We allow digital readers, including devices with audiobook capabilities. The data archive from Earth contains every work ever published, and free access to that is a dream come true for some of the colonists, people whose only desire is a quiet corner of the universe where they can do an honest day's work and read themselves to sleep. Videos are another matter. Roughly half want access to the movies and TV in the data archive.
The rest won't budge on the issue. In the end, it gets voted down. We'll have to make do with live theater, which for many colonists is woefully less engaging than the entertainment they grew up with. But for our descendants, it will be all they've ever known, and that's why we're doing it. To a large extent, we're making all these sacrifices for our children. At least, those of us who can have children. Music, however, is something no one wants to give up. As with literature, we've brought every piece of music ever recorded on Earth. It is truly a treasure trove, and it's made available free to every colonist. A law is made, however, preventing piracy of newly made art. Music is the lubricant that enables many of us to get through these grueling early days. Anthems that remind us of where we came from, of times before the darkness on Earth. How to access the music library returns the debate to screens once more. Again, the majority are against, which means network-connected speakers with voice command. Soon, colonists are calling for Ari to play everything from Beethoven's Fifth to Fire on the Mountain by the Marshall Tucker Band. There's something bizarre and strangely comforting about setting fence posts on an alien world to the sound of George Strait's performance of Amarillo by Morning. The citizens do approve a personal communications device. The design is for a lightweight wristband, like a watch with no face or screen. It responds to ARI and can call any other wristband or connected home device. It also monitors the vitals of the person wearing it, reporting any danger to medical instantly. Unfortunately, without the 3D printers, we can't actually make most of the technology we approve. Periodically, I'm instructed to seek out Oscar and have him manufacture our designs. As the colonists gradually come to terms with their new limits on technology, Emma and I gradually get used to living with each other. We have our ups and downs. With the exception of her tours in the ISS, she has lived alone her entire adult life. As for me, let's just say prison wasn't the greatest primer for domestic life. We're like two puzzle pieces that looked like they would fit, but once brought together, didn't snap into place instantly. We both have rough edges that weren't apparent at first glance. Where those rough edges meet, there's been friction. In a way, we've sort of filed away at ourselves, giving and taking to make our lives fit together. I think doing that has been worth it. With a tighter fit, the pieces are likely to stay together longer. We make a few major additions to the town, namely a dome overhead that simulates night. That helps with the insomnia some of us have felt. We now have day and night, and I count down those days until Alex, along with Abby and Sarah, will be brought out of stasis. When it occurs, I'm not standing there waiting for him. I want to, but I know it's not the right time. I watch from a distance, waiting for him to emerge from the ship. I haven't seen him in decades. Well, technically, it's been thousands of years. Either way, it's a long time. When my brother walks out into the light, my heart sinks. He looks as though the world has ground him down. His face is lined. Dark bags hang under his eyes. He's graying at the temples, hair receding. I don't know if it was Jack's death, or dealing with a child with an addiction problem, or just life. But Alex has had it hard. Sarah is screaming and kicking and punching anyone who gets near her.
You kidnapped me! I'll kill you all! Don't touch me!
Izumi creeps up behind her and quickly presses a dispenser to her neck. Sarah spins, raising her fist, but Alex rushes forward and wraps his arms around her, holding his daughter tight, tears forming in his eyes as she goes limp. For the next 3 days, I avoid Alex. Sarah is being treated in the ship's med bay. I want to hug Alex and tell him I'm with him. Instead, I creep around town like a burglar to visit Izumi, who assures me everything will be all right. At dinner that night, Emma sets down her fork and fixes me with a stare I've come to know. It's the, "Come on now, James," stare. She uses it at least bi-weekly.
What? This is a very small town, James. You're going to have to talk to him eventually, and by eventually I mean tomorrow or the next day, not next week.
I know. So you're going to see him?
Sure.
When?
I don't know. When the time's right.
She shakes her head and collects the dishes, depositing them in the sink for me to wash. I'm scrubbing a plate when I hear the front door close.
Emma?
I call. But there's no reply. My hands are covered in suds when the door opens again. I turn to find Alex standing there, Emma behind him. She nods to me, then turns and leaves.
Water drips from my forearms onto the floor. Neither of us move.
She told me what you did, Alex says. That we're here because of you.
I nod, unsure what to say, not trusting my voice. He takes a step toward me. I grab a towel from the counter and wipe off my hands and arms. When he reaches me, Alex puts his arms around me and says 6 words that are like a soothing balm on a hurt deep inside of me, a wound that time never fully healed.
Thank you. I love you, brother.
Chapter 60. James. For Alex and me, it feels like a new beginning. Things aren't exactly like they used to be between us. It never will be. That's okay. Having him in my life is more than enough. Slowly we become a family again. Alex and Abby begin coming over for dinner. The conversations are cautious at first, each side feeling the other out, afraid to raise any subject that might upset the other. The first dinner is an hour of small talk and pleasantries. Abby and Emma are pretty good at it. Alex and I just seem awkward, like 2 recently feuding middle school boys on a double date. Like Emma and me, our relationship with Abby and Alex is like our 2 pieces of a puzzle fitting with their 2 pieces. It takes some time, but we finally settle in, and it's the best feeling I've had in a while. Each week, Sarah gets better. Alex and Abby are overjoyed. They seem to be coming to life, as if a weight is being lifted from them. Time together fills the hole in my relationship with Alex. I spend time with him on my days off, hiking and reminiscing about our youth, always dancing around the subject that tore us apart. Dad. Each day throws a shovel of dirt in the rift between us. Soon the chasm is gone, replaced by fresh dirt. The scar we know is there, but far better than the emptiness I have known. When they finally bring Sarah over for dinner, it's a chaotic event. To date, she's been receiving inpatient care in the ship, trying to adapt to life without VR.
You're lunatics, she says as soon as we all sit down. It's obvious she holds Emma and me responsible for what's happened to her,
far more so than her parents. Or maybe we're just a fresh target. I open my mouth, but Emma responds before I have a chance.
How are we lunatics?
I'm grateful for the intervention. I think she's trying to get in between me and Sarah, to stop me from adding any strain to my already fragile relationship with Alex.
Where do I even start? Sarah snaps. We flew here in a spaceship to play medieval times?
Not to nitpick, but it's more like colonial times, Emma says, trying to lighten the mood.
Whatever. You're all crazy, acting like we don't have technology. I'm living in an alien insane asylum.
We're not against using technology. Izumi uses it all the time. Technology is playing the music we're hearing right now and lighting this house. We're against anything that might change us, endanger us.
Just send me back to Earth. You all can play Frontier Settlers until the universe ends for all I care.
Going back to Earth would be unwise. Sarah laughs.
That's rich. The captain of a ship of fools judging my wisdom.
A small smile forms on Emma's lips, the mysterious expression I've always found so captivating. What she says, I'll never forget. Only time will judge our wisdom. With Kappa's infrastructure nearly complete, I have a new challenge, one I haven't faced since that day Olivia told me I wasn't going to be part of her future. I have to figure out what I want to do for a living. Robotics, as an industry, won't ever exist here. As someone who has spent his entire career either inventing new technology or doing laundry for convicts, there's only one career I'm now qualified for. But Emma prefers doing our laundry, and has assigned me to washing dishes. And since the two of us don't dirty enough dishes to occupy my working time, I need to find a new profession. The more I concentrate on the problem, the more frustrated I become. I know what I'm looking for, a profession where I can grow personally, doing work that makes a big difference in people's lives. That's what drew me to robotics. Now, with the advantage of hindsight, I see the great mistake I made. When Olivia pushed me away, when she hurt me, I never wanted to be hurt again. I wanted to get away from people, to do something out of the reach of selfish, irrational humans. I felt safe around machines. But in a way, working on robots took away some of my humanity. My creations always did what I said. They never pushed back, never forced me to compromise. I came to believe too much in the future I was building. I never considered that others weren't ready. I didn't understand human nature. I still don't. But I want to. In short, I want to work with people. I want to understand them, to fill in my own blind spots. I want to change lives. For a time, I considered taking some of the medical education courses in the data archive, brushing up on my education. The problem is that the colony is already more than well supplied with healthcare staff, most of whom are more skilled than I am, or can ever become. I won't ever be a great surgeon. I'm too geeky to ever be Kappa's favorite family physician. And the simple truth is, it's not right for me. I want to build things. Healthcare is, at its core, about repair and maintenance. It's a noble endeavor, but one I'll never excel at, and won't be happy doing. The true moments of euphoria in my life were when I created something new, something that pushed the bounds of possibility, something the world had never seen, something that had the potential to change lives forever. And I'm living in a world where that's not possible, where there is no profession in which I can experience such a moment. There are few agonies worse than grasping about for a new career in a world where you seem to have no place. It's as though I'm the odd man out in a game of duck-duck-goose, watching people settle into their lives, happy as a clam, while I stand here with no place and no prospects. It hits the person at their core. Emma senses my gloom and is encouraging. When I stop making progress, she becomes more aggressive. Stop stewing on it. You've worked the problem to death. So give up? Take time off. Do something you enjoy. Can't. It's against the law. Well, do some work. Anything to get your mind off of it. Help Grigori at the bike shop. It's good advice. I'm not so far gone that I can't see that. Grigori and I make quite a pair. Two grumpy old men toiling in the shop, fixing bikes, mostly for kids, reminiscing about the days when we built starships, androids, and drones, or a couple of has-beens. At dinner one night, Emma corners me again, pressing me on how work is going. Terrible. It's going terrible. She sighs. Why? Bored. In a word, I feel bored. It's repetitive work. We don't do anything new. Just one bike after another. Each one the same. And as of last week, everybody's got a bike. The repairs now barely fill a day for us. She smiles, trying to encourage me. Which means you made a pretty good product. We made ourselves obsolete. So try something else. Painting. My portraits would be indistinguishable from landscape compositions. Then do landscape paintings. Emma, there are uncertainties here on Aurora, but there is one thing I know beyond the shadow of a doubt. Your partner is not the person to capture this alien world's likeness in watercolor, not by a long shot. You could write? Fiction? Sure. That's what you did all of your career. Create. You wrote lots of code. My fiction is likely to read like a piece of software, or a children's book not actually written for children. My frustration finally infects Emma. She exhales heavily, and a long, awkward moment stretches out between us. She's just trying to help me, and I'm attacking her, taking out my frustration on the one person I should be thankful for. In my subconscious, I probably resent her to some degree. She's found a job she loves here, as a city planner. She seems to fit in effortlessly while I'm treading water and sinking slowly. But my problems aren't her fault. Far from it. I'm about to apologize when she says, "Hey, if you guys aren't making new bikes and the repairs don't fill a day, what have you been doing?" "Making roller skates." "You've been making roller skates for over a week and you haven't mentioned that?" I shrug. "Yeah, why? You want a pair?" "What do you think?" The more I think about my career dilemma, the more elusive it becomes. I see only the paths closed to me, and I dwell on the ones that will never be open. As I slip further into the sandpit of despair that is my life, Emma becomes more aggressive with her interventions. One rest day we hike to the top of a nearby peak, where she points down at the collection of simple homes and buildings that make up our growing little city. "What do you see?" "Kappa," I mumble. "Wrong. Down there is quite possibly the last place of human habitation in the universe, and it wouldn't be here without you.
Without the android you created, Oscar, it wouldn't be here. In all likelihood, none of us would.
I see her point, but still I resist. My problem is not what I've done. It's that I have nothing to do.
Your problem is that you're letting your problem eat you alive. You're internalizing it, not working it objectively like you would any other problem. Let's solve it. Let's brainstorm up here, and just pick something. While you're trying the first thing, we'll think of two more things to try next.
I stare at Kappa below as she continues.
You want to build things. You want them to matter to people. You want to work with people.
It hits me then. I've been staring at it the whole time. It's perfect.
I have an idea,
I say quietly, still gazing at the city below.
You do?
It's solid gold.
Emma lights up.
It is?
Definitely.
What is it?
I'm not going to tell you.
I'm going to show you.
It's perfect.
Her enthusiasm morphs to apprehension.
What are you thinking?
Trust me. I just need to talk to Grigori first. I'm going to need help with engineering.
The next morning in the bike shop, I present my idea for my new career to Grigori. He studies my face, looking pained.
You're serious?
He asks.
Completely.
When he doesn't reply, I press him.
Are you in?
What choice do I have? Face it, James. None of your designs would ever get off the ground without my calculations. They certainly won't stay up.
I'll take that as an enthusiastic yes.
For the next month, I study, do research, and work on my initial designs. At dinner one night, I slide a stack of papers across the table to Emma.
Behold!
She laughs.
Behold what?
My new career!
She flips the pages over and studies the first one, seeming confused at first.
You drew this?
With the help of a scaled ruler and a protractor, yes. This is what I want to do here on Aurora.
Design homes?
And build them. Everyone will be unique, because it will be customized to the residents. To me, success won't be a question of the size of the home, the grandeur, or the wow factor.
It's designing a home that's right for its inhabitant. To do that, you have to understand your client. You have to know what they value, how they live their days and spend their time. You have to understand their nature. It's perfect for me. I'll get to study people and build things that will be here generations after I'm gone. Our homes are a personal reflection of us, and they have a huge impact on people's lives. Homes are where we become families, where we retreat when the world comes crashing down on us. They're the place where we can do the things we truly want, and the design has to support that. She studies the drawings, flipping to the next plan. And then the next.
I drew three rough plans. I wanted to have a few options for us to start from.
She nods, still mesmerized by the drawings.
I figured you might like one or two things from a few of the plans, and I can incorporate them in the next round.
She looks up suddenly. These are for us?
Of course. I want to design and build our home first.
She returns to the drawings, not saying a word.
I mean, I've still got a lot to learn. Our house will be sort of a beta version. Might have some issues.
When she doesn't say anything, I hold a hand up and wave my fingers back and forth, urging her.
Say something. What do you think?
I can honestly say I didn't see this coming. My heart begins to sink. She hates it. I was crazy for even going down this path.
Nuts. Home building. The designs are a waste of paper.
She flips back through the pages again.
Incredible, she whispers. It's totally incredible, James. Wait, you like it?
Which one?
All of them. They're so quaint, cozy. It's us, completely us. I mean, I'd like a bigger laundry room. The pantry is too small in option B, but as a start, it's amazing.
Grigori is going to do the point load calculations and the rest of the structural engineering. He's been studying up on that, too.
They're going to work together?
As partners.
Interesting. What's the name of this new enterprise? I was thinking Sinclair and Sokolov.
Sounds like a law firm.
Grigori insisted it should be Sokolov and Sinclair. He's certain that my houses would, in his words, never stay off the ground without him. Hence his name coming first. We got into a chicken and egg sort of philosophical debate about that.
And what was the outcome?
We flipped for it. When he lost, Grigori made us go 2 out of 3, but he won the next two. I objected at that point, and after some discussion we settled on calling it S&S Holmes. Emma laughs. You two are perfect for each other. And I think this is going to be perfect for you, James. I'll do whatever I can to help you.
Chapter 61. James. It's been 3 months since the last colonists emerged from stasis. For all of us, life on Aurora is an adjustment. People are carving out roles for themselves in this simple life, and we're fine-tuning the systems we'll live by. Currency, economy, government, spiritual beliefs, and laws. The shape of civilization here on Aurora is more or less like it was on Earth, with one subtle but critical change. We place value on the health and happiness of citizens, not progress. We don't care how large our economy is, how vast our nation is, how resource-rich it is. But I understand why it was like that on Earth. You had what were essentially tribes of different cultures and beliefs emerging at the same time, struggling to protect their people and their way of life. Here, we have the luxury of creating a single way of life shared by a single group of people. And most importantly, we are safe. We don't need to make progress and invent new things to protect ourselves. We aren't better than the people we left behind on Earth. We simply have the advantage of hindsight, of seeing where their choices led. We have the benefit of the technology that civilization yielded. The difference between us and them, in short, is where we started from. That perspective is important, and we've written it in our history. For some reason, it feels to me like time here on Aurora stands still. I see things change, windmills go up, rail lines stretch out, pasture land expands, and water mills dip into the river. But somehow I don't feel the passage of time. I think it's because the seasons don't change. Our clothes are mostly the same. Our routines don't shift. Tara establishes a police station, but she's the only officer. There are no robberies, not much crime, only a few domestic disputes that get out of hand. Ours is a society where we leave our doors unlocked at night, where kids walk the streets alone without fear. At the moment, the homes that line those streets are utilitarian boxes. My vision is of a town of quaint homes that reflect their owners, homes that are a fusion of design beauty and innovative engineering. If Grigori and I are successful, someday walking the streets of Kappa will be like strolling through an open-air gallery of residential architecture. I fine-tune the plans for the new house I intend to build for Emma and me, and at dinner I slide them across the table. She pushes her bowl of soup aside and studies them. I hate this moment, when she's utterly silent, offering no hint as to whether or not she likes it. The plan is a combination of the first three. It's an English cottage with Tudor and Jacobean elements. It's cozy, efficient, just what we need and nothing else. A small foyer opens onto a living area to the left, the kitchen straight ahead, and a mudroom to the right. The living area joins the dining room via a large opening. Beyond the living and dining are a master suite and a guest bedroom. Her eyes stop at that section of the home. Two bedrooms, she says quietly. The comment is somewhere between a question and an expression of regret. Why would we need two bedrooms? The chance that a family has passed us by. It's funny how your home defines the stages of your life. A childhood home first, a dorm or apartment next, living alone, usually in a condo or one-bedroom apartment, a starter home, a family home with bedrooms, and for some, downsizing to an empty nest abode. Before the VR epidemic, most people followed some form of that path. For Emma and me, putting the plan on paper is a tangible definition of where we are and what the road ahead holds. What is unsaid is the paths that are forever closed to us. I figure it could be a guest bedroom, just in case. And you never know, I'll probably get fat and start snoring at some point. She smiles without laughing, still studying the pages. No office for you? When I'm at home, I want to be focused on what's at home. You, our life. You think you can do that? Yes, I'll only work at the office. I like that. When do you start building? I've been waiting on plan approval from the boss. You have it. While Grigori and I embark on setting up our building company, Izumi and Emma launch a major project of their own,
cataloging all of the plants and animals on Aurora. We want to build things. They want to understand the world around us and coexist. I guess we all brought some predispositions from Earth. The adults on Aurora are excited about what Grigori and I are doing. They want to get out of their basic housing and into more comfortable living quarters. The children could care less. They are, however, delighted by Emma and Izumi's project, which they've named NOAA, Naming of Aurora Hosts. All the kids volunteer for Phase 1 gathering, and soon Kappa's swarming with kids carrying tiny containers with insects crawling up the side or fluttering their wings trying to escape. Hordes more children follow the trappers through town, trying to catch a glimpse of the cages that hold furry four-legged creatures. They've even made volunteering for NOAA part of the curriculum at school, an alternative to class time. The specimens are housed in a new building called the Ark, Aurora Root Collection. It's right beside the Great Dining Hall, and on the eve of every rest day, it's packed with families moving through, studying the new animals and existing exhibits, like visitors at a sprawling alien zoo. Grigori and I have a booth near the entrance, where I display my designs and try to generate interest. We're probably the least visited stop, but we're gathering a list of potential clients. When Grigori arrives, I rise from the stool and silently hand over the booth to him. He sulks as he takes his place behind the counter, peeking at the sign-up form.
"I feel like medieval peasant begging outside city zoo," he mutters.
I smile. "Ah, you get used to it." He mumbles in Russian as I walk away, suppressing a laugh. Aurora has done a lot of good things for the colonists. It has returned us to nature, to a more simple life. Most of all, it has taken us out of our comfort zones. For Grigori, asking for people's business is something he's never had to do. He hates it. But I think it will be good for him, ultimately. I think knowing his customer, and knowing that he ultimately works for those people, will make for a better product. It also helps us keep our egos in check. Up ahead, I spot Emma standing by a new wing of the Ark. It opened tonight, and it's absolutely packed. I bet half the city is here, and the rest are not far behind. The line of people snakes through the corridor, which is lined with plastic containers lying on their sides, the open ends facing such that everyone can get a good look at what's inside. Emma grabs my arm. "You have to see this." Up ahead, children are running back and forth, laughing and pointing. "Watch," she whispers. A girl who looks to be about 6 years old skips forward, turning her head to a container. A cloud of gray dust springs forward, engulfing her face. She swats it away, laughing. Izumi is on the other side of the corridor, standing in front of a group of children with what looks like gray pollen on their clothes. Using a broom, Izumi pushes a cart through the corridor, past the plastic containers with a cloud of mist shot forth. This time, no cloud emerges. "It doesn't react to non-living matter," Emma whispers. "What is it? You'll see." Behind me, I hear my brother Alex calling to the crowd, "Make way!" The group parts, and he marches forward, a leash in hand. The animal he's escorting is a mix of a dog and a kangaroo. It stands on four legs, but its hind legs are massive compared to its two front limbs. Its muzzle is bound, and it looks somewhere between confused and scared. On the other side of the mist-producing container, Izumi readies a small specimen cup. "Go ahead." Alex places a hand on the animal's back and urges it forward. It hop-walks past the container, the leash extending. This time a green cloud emerges. Izumi rushes forward, trapping some of the particles in her specimen cup. The moment she reaches the cloud, another wave of gray mist flies out. Izumi coughs as she retreats. "It seems to react differently to whatever it encounters," Emma says. "It's truly incredible." For the next half hour, we watch the kids passing by, delighted by the spray that they claim is cool and funny feeling. I think the fact that one child did it and seemed to enjoy it is now compelling every other child in Kappa to do it. In adolescence, missing out on the fun is a mortal fear. Finally, Emma leads me to the plastic container. I snap my eyes shut and swat away the cloud of gray that surrounds us. When it's gone, I see lumps of gray sponge that seem to be shrinking before my eyes. "We think it's a fungus," Emma says, eyeing it.
"How does it produce so much pollen or mist or whatever?"
"We think it's cannibalizing its own matter to synthesize the spores on the fly. It would make sense. The outer layers of fungus would sacrifice themselves to protect the layers below it, and so on. The particles it emits change color and seem to adapt to whatever type of visitor it encounters. Maybe it's driven by pheromones it detects, or the size of the potential predator. It creates the spores instantly. When it's alone, with no other living matter around, there are no spores inside the organism.
Interesting. Is it dangerous?
No, we wouldn't be displaying any of the Ark specimens if Oscar and his team hadn't already tested the entire planet. When I return to the booth to collect Grigori, I'm delighted to find that we have 3 new signups for our interest list.
You're quite the salesman, Grigori.
He rises and trudges out of the booth.
Almost as good as your jokes.
At the dining hall, the gray fungus, which Izumi has named Oris regolithus, is the talk of the town. Those who didn't see it before the meal flock to the Ark after. I wake with a headache and sinus pressure. Emma seems to be feeling bad, too. It might be a sinus issue, she says. Some kind of weather change.
The rogue planet won't affect Aurora's orbit until next year.
True, she says, pushing her breakfast around her plate. It could be something else. Even a slight variation in weather might affect us. I'll look into it. The cough starts at work. With each passing hour, I feel worse, like a cold is coming on. I'm not the only one. Grigori looks like the walking dead, and during the lunch rush, the diner next door feels more like the waiting area at a doctor's office in winter. People coughing, rubbing their temples, exhaling deeply. Something's very wrong here. After lunch, I don't return to the office. I make my way to the ship. There's a line outside, stretching from the entrance like the gathering at the new Ark exhibit last night. The whole town must be sick. I push my way past toward the medbay. Tara stands by the door, serving as a gatekeeper and guard, letting people in one family at a time. The door opens, and Alex, Abby, and Sarah walk out. My brother's face is pale, eyes bloodshot. He holds a hand up to cover his cough.
Are you sick, too?
He asks. I nod.
I think so. What is it? Flu? Something like that. Don't worry.
I push past him into the medbay. Izumi is wearing a face mask, and in her eyes I see the fear I'm feeling.